The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. If you listened to the program last Saturday, you heard my 2001 interview with the author Susan Vreeland. She had a book out that was really amazing. I absolutely loved the book. It was called Girl in Hyacinth Blue. It was a collection of linked short stories about an imaginary painting by the painter Vermeer. And that book was originally self-published on a very small press, and then it was picked up by a major publisher and reissued in paperback. And at the time I interviewed Susan, the book had just come out in paperback. It was a bestseller. She had just signed a contract to have it made into a television movie, and she was on top of the world. Susan had spent 30 years as a high school teacher in San Diego. And she wrote the book, Girl in Hyacinth Blue, as she was dealing with a diagnosis of lymphoma. And she found that art was something that took her mind off of her illness and helped her with her healing process. And she talked about it during my second interview with her. Another book about fine art. It's called The Passion of Artemisia. I called Susan at her home in San Diego back in 2002, and we recorded this interview. And Susan died last year. Here's Susan Vreeland from the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Susan Vreeland. You might recall the last time she was here was with her book, Girl in Hyacinth Blue. She has a new novel out. It's called The Passion of Artemisia. Welcome back, Susan.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Susan, for those of our listeners who didn't hear the prior interview, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into this writing thing?
I was a high school teacher for 30 years and an avid reader, and I began to teach creative writing. I wrote travel journalism at the time, and some art, not art criticism, but features on local artists, and that opened my world to art a little bit, and I think I began writing those newspaper and magazine stories in about 1980. But then by around 1985 or 6, I had a hankering to try fiction. And I put my foot rather timidly into the fiction realm by writing a novel that was loosely based on the lives of people I knew. That came out in 1988. What Love Sees, it's out of print now, but it was made into a CBS television movie with Richard Thomas. Then I thought, well, maybe this is where I should really develop my skills in fiction, but I still had a lot to learn, so I turned to short stories and wrote short fiction for a number of years. Now we're getting closer to the novel that was more publicized, Girl in Hyacinth Blue, which I thought of at the time as a series of short stories linked, as they were, by an imagined Vermeer painting.
Mm-hmm. And so you did Girl in Hyacinth Blue, and the thing that really touched me about this book was what was going on in your own life at the time that you were writing this.
And oh, you remember that.
I can't forget that, Susan.
That's right. I was being treated for lymphoma for a period of about 2 years. And it was during that time that I wrote Girl in Hyacinth Blue. I think it was the upliftment of looking at art books that moved me to write about art, and I've been writing art-related fiction ever since. Those interiors of Vermeer with calm women seemingly content with their domestic environment gave me a great sense of peace, and I appreciated Vermeer for that. But also other artists gave me other qualities that I wanted to grasp onto during this difficult time in my life. The Impressionists gave me that joie de vivre, that color, that gladness of being alive and interacting with other human beings and with the natural world. That vivified me. Michelangelo's figures on the Sistine ceiling, strong, powerful, at one with their God. That's the quality I needed, that that God-derived strength, I guess. And so I enriched my life so much during that time just from reading art books and from sinking myself into the reproductions. That it seemed to me that if art could uplift me in this kind of grim situation, then maybe there were other people out there who maybe were not museum goers, whose lives had not interacted with art as mine had, but maybe they were readers of fiction, and I might bring them through fiction to an appreciation of art that might uplift them if they so needed it. I suppose that's my motivation and still is. Out of gratitude, I have to say.
I was so inspired by your story and by Girl in Hyacinth Blue. You might recall when you were here that I told you about my mother, who was quite ill at the time with cancer.
Yes.
And you signed a copy of the book for her, and I also sent her a copy of our interview, and she enjoyed it tremendously, and she savored each one of those stories.
Aww.
She would read one of them a week because she wanted them to last as long as possible.
Aww.
My guest is Susan Vreeland. Her book is The Passion of Artemisia. Who was Artemisia?
Artemisia Gentileschi was a female in the Baroque period, post-Renaissance, who became a well-known painter. Her father, Orazio Gentileschi, was also a well-known painter, and it really had to be by the proximity of having a father or a relative be an artist that a woman of the 17th century, early 17th, could gain the training. Academies that were just developing in the late Renaissance were closed to women. Prior to that, the apprenticeship system also closed to women. You know, I had the seeds of this novel, The Passion of Artemisia, in Girl in Hyacinth Blue, Vic. I didn't even realize that I had planted them, but they're in my last story in Girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the point of view of Vermeer's daughter who longs to paint.
Uh-huh.
She sees with the eye of a painter, and she's always imagining compositions. Even at the moment of her father's death, when she washed him in bed that last time, she had a thought, the shame of which kept her from uttering. it would make a fine painting. And then she imagines the composition. She's standing by the bedside with a blue figured washing bowl. Her mother's on the other side clutching a crucifix, and her father is lying there, eyes glazed, already looking to another canvas, another landscape. And she longed to paint him, but the task was too fearsome. She lacked the skill, and the one to teach her had never offered. And that paragraph from Girl in Hyacinth Blue stayed with me for a number of months until I began looking for a daughter whose father had taught her to paint, and came across Artemisia.
Was that difficult to find one?
Well, at first it was. My first source was a book called The Obstacle Race by Germaine Greer. And it published in 1979, right at the cusp of new feminist art criticism. It opened a scholarship about women who were painting right alongside men but weren't in the art history books. And Germaine Greer's book had a short passages of a couple paragraphs about many, many women. But that book had an entire chapter called The Magnificent Exception, devoted to Artemisia. Greer explains the lack of training possibilities, the expectations that women should be wives and mothers and not do anything that would attract public attention as the obstacles to women in art. But then explain that despite these and many other obstacles, Artemisia Gentileschi succeeded.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, you are listening to the Best of the Book Nook this morning, and returning to my interview recorded back in 2002 with Susan Vreeland for her novel, The Passion of Artemisia. I'll continue with my interview with Susan right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 2002 interview with Susan Vreeland. We were talking about her novel, The Passion of Artemisia, which came out following her best-selling book, Girl in Hyacinth Blue. And if you heard the program last Saturday morning, I brought you that interview with Susan for Girl in Hyacinth Blue. And we talked about this book that she was working on, and I tracked her down after the book came out, The Passion of Artemisia, and called her on the telephone in San Diego and recorded this conversation back in 2002. My guest is Susan Vreeland. Her book is The Passion of Artemisia. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Tell us about this portrait on the cover of your book.
It's called Female Martyr. It's thought to be Artemisia's own face, which she used frequently during her career. And even it's conjectured that one of her paintings, Susanna and the Elders, a nude, uses her own nude body. Now, that's a striking item of bravery in her biography.
Mm-hmm.
Already she was living on the edge in terms of reputation because of a rape and a court trial. But for her to do a painting that used herself as the nude was tremendously brave. Although, come to think of it now, that painting, Susanna and the Elders, was done when she was 17 years old.
Amazing.
And the rape occurred, we assume, at about the same age, the painting done prior to it, shows from the biblical, the apocryphal story, two men leering at a woman as she gets out of the bath, a pool in a garden. And they're threatening her. They want their way with her, and she resists them.
Yesterday, my guest on this program was the novelist Elizabeth Berg, and she has a collection of short stories, and we were talking about one of them. And it was a story that takes place on Christmas, and a family has gotten together. And I asked her what the story was about, and she said, it's about forgiveness and a woman trying to forgive her father for the way he's been. And I thought, I flashed on that when I finished your book, and I said, you know, this is a book about forgiveness too, particularly about forgiving a father. But it's really about forgiving a lot of people and a lot of things and a lot of events that have happened in her life.
It is indeed. I mean, she had several betrayals. The man who raped her was her father's collaborator, whom he hired to teach her perspective. She wanted to keep it a secret. Her father, when he found out, took it to court. Perhaps he was trying to clear her reputation, but it seemed rather self-serving, the court testimony indicated that in his plea he said that the rape had damaged his ability to sell his daughter's painting talent for so high a price. That's direct from the trial transcript. So she had a father to forgive, a rapist, and she had later had a arranged marriage that went awry. It seems that all her life she had to transcend the accusations and scandal that the father's exposure of her set into motion.
She even had to learn how to forgive her daughter after a while. But the passion of Artemisia throughout this, the thing that sustains her is her art. And I love the way you get into her head and you help us to understand how she would look at a painting, how she would consider a project, how she would decide how to portray something. This was fascinating.
Oh, good. I had to study her work to do that, and was amazed again and again at her courage in working out the issues of her own life on canvas, portraying women who were thinking women, women going against the grain, women caught in moments of decision when they would maybe not make the conventional decision.
Portraying herself.
At times.
Mm. You describe a woman who's going against the grain. That was truly her. And in Italy at that time, of course, we have all these different city-states. And did she really go to all these different places and live in all these different cities? She's in Rome, she's in Florence, Venice, Naples, Genoa. She's all over the map.
Rome, Florence, Venice, Naples are the documented cities that she lived in. It was my invention to have her go to Genoa. You know, there were some of her paintings that were found in the Palazzi of Genoa. And here is a fiction writer's prerogative to use an invention in the service of a narrative. I needed to have a man who was not negative. Look at the three men that I've already described. They all betrayed her. The rapist was a murderer also. And I needed to temper that. So
you fictionalized the good guy.
I suppose you said that. You could say that.
Had to make him up.
I had to. At first, I thought that she actually did live in Genoa. There were some art historical books that indicated that, one by Ward Bissell. And then later, he wrote another book saying that he had readjusted that assumption. But by then, I had already created this character of her patron in Genoa. And the patron's family that was loving. I needed a time for her that was uplifting, that was a happy time.
I think we all needed it, Susan.
During the reading of that?
I think we all need uplifting in our life, and in your book, for sure. We needed a period of time when they nurtured her talent, when
right.
she was happy, until
right.
her father ruins it again.
Yeah, but you know, the growth that I wanted her to move toward was the growth toward making her own happiness under whatever circumstances. I mean, that isn't that what we're all striving for?
I think so, Susan.
Under whatever circumstances. Resentment, misfortune, I wanted her to transcend those in order to taste the possibilities of forgiveness and love in this ruptured life and be able to finally say to her father this line when her father is close to his death and feels that he hasn't achieved his potential. She says to him, "We've been lucky. We've been able to live by what we love.
Mm-hmm.
And to live painting as we have, wherever we have, is to live passion and imagination and connection and adoration, all the best of life, to be more alive than the rest."
Doing what you love, there's something to be said for that, Susan Vreeland. There really is. The book is The Passion of Artemisia. Susan Vreeland wrote it. She joins us by telephone from Southern California. Susan, I had Dava Sobel on the program a couple of years ago with her wonderful book, Galileo's Daughter. And I got a flash of that, too, because you bring Galileo into this book. Did he actually know her? Do you know?
Yes, he did. I read a letter that she wrote to him, which part of which I used in the book, in which she asks him to intervene on her behalf, to encourage Cosimo de' Medici to pay up one of the paintings. Was the account for one of the paintings had been neglected. So she must have known him well enough to ask this favor of him. And in this letter, she kind of teases him at the beginning and said, "Now don't think that I don't write to you except when I need you."
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me a little flavor of the warmth of their relationship. Galileo was about 20 years older than she.
Would you call this period the late Renaissance, or is it post-Renaissance?
I don't know what date to...
Because Michelangelo is...
Oh, he was 100 years earlier.
So is it still...
It would almost be post-Renaissance.
Okay.
In terms of painting styles... Italy went through, even after the Renaissance, a period of mannerism before the Baroque. And this would be called the Baroque.
Okay.
So let's call it post-Renaissance. But Galileo was certainly a figure in her life.
The way you depict Rome is pretty scary as far as the people... The way that they treat Artemisia after this horrendous trial that she went through. And you paint a vivid portrait of the way that at women were often mistreated during this period. I found it very striking, very powerful.
Thank you. You know, if you look at the minor female characters, they offer solutions or avenues that women could take if they had not had an easy life. We have a nun who was once married, loved art, had to, was actually given no alternative after the death of her husband but to go into a convent. So she is a rather unconventional nun. We have a model who had two sons but no husband, who always had to have foremost in her mind how to make it financially by attaching herself to a man. We had a servant girl in Genoa and a dyer's daughter working the vats in Florence. And all of these women, and then the penitent, there was this wild penitent woman, ragged, in front of the cathedral in Florence, beating her breast and moaning for some imagined past sin, almost an incarnation of Mary Magdalene.
She turns up a lot.
these were typical of the women's lives at the time.
The nun, she comes back into the story on a number of occasions. The whole scene with the convent, we have this world that's full of art, and yet we have this line, this invisible barrier where it's really for rich people. It's really for people that have money to enjoy. And then there's even a bigger line drawn at the edge of this convent where you're not supposed to talk. You're not supposed to see any of this beautiful art. You can't even walk down the street and see a statue.
Some convents had that confinement and others did not. The convent that I used was Santa Trinita, which is on the hill above the Spanish Steps, though the scalinata, the steps, were not there when Artemisia lived there. But actually, at the time that Artemisia lived, that may have been a monastery for monks instead of nuns. Mm. I was able to stay there, and it did give me a sense of reclusion from the world. From my window, I could see the church domes, including the Vatican, across the rooftops of Rome. And from that, I imagined that longing of Sister Graziella to explore all of those places in Rome that she had known when she was a young girl.
I think I just understood a little joke that you inserted into the book, Susan. When they're going to the convent, Artemisia and her daughter complains that there aren't any steps.
Yes.
I think I just got that one.
It's a magnificent staircase now.
Okay.
Tourists hang out there to view Rome and throw coins in the fountain and at the base of the steps. And there's always people hawking things there. Sunglasses, sun hats, cameras, film, everything a tourist would need.
Mm-hmm.
But Artemisia had to climb up that rutted, deep dirt pathway.
Susan, I take it you spent some time in Italy working on this book. That must have been a lot of fun for you.
Oh, yes, but it wasn't very much time, Vic.
Oh.
I was invited to teach a fiction class in Tuscany, very short, for a week. But I extended it another week and divided that time between Florence and Rome. I had to determine what Artemisia could see, whether she could smell the river from her house, what those stairs up the bell tower in Florence were like to climb, what she could see from the top. Certainly other tourists, thousands of tourists have done that climb. And I had to, too, because how could I describe it in a way that would be accurate?
Is this the climb where she goes up with her husband? And
yeah.
Okay.
During the rainstorm.
Right.
And they have an erotic moment at the top.
That's quite a powerful scene. The book is The Passion of Artemisia. My guest is Susan Vreeland. It's her new novel. I was in Rome a couple of years ago and in Florence, and Florence is such an incredible place. To see those churches alone, it's just phenomenal. You really capture that sense of awe with the architecture of Florence in your book.
And, you know, it's such a compact city. I mean, the things that that an art lover or a traveler would want to see are all within walking distance, and those routes on those same streets were the ones that Artemisia took. One street is called, I think, Via Tintoretti, the avenue of the cloth dyers or tinters. And that's what gave me the idea for a character, just walking on that street, well, looking at that street on a map and then translating the name of the street in my Italian dictionary. I don't speak Italian.
Is that where she found the model with the golden dress?
That's right.
Mm. Well, it really captures Italy, and it does a wonderful...
I hope you can see that it was great fun for me to invent those characters.
I can tell. I really can.
And those scenes.
This is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we are going back into our archive today to listen to an interview I recorded in 2002 with Susan Vreeland for her book, The Passion of Artemisia. Susan died last year, and she made 3 visits to the program over the years, and she was a favorite guest of mine. We'll bring you the final segment of that interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 2002 interview with Susan Vreeland for her novel, The Passion of Artemisia.
My guest is Susan Vreeland. Susan, what's next for you? Are you working on anything?
I'm working on 2 things. One is a story collection dealing with art-related, of course. Half of the stories deal with Impressionist painters from the point of view of someone peripheral to their lives. Manet's wife, as she's trying to determine which of his models gave him syphilis. That's a darker one.
Oh.
But there's plenty of lighter ones. The Renoir story I'm working on just this morning is from the point of view of the father of a 4-year-old girl he paints called Girl with a Watering Can. Is this precious girl in a blue velvet dress in a garden. There's a Monet story from the point of view of his gardener at Giverny, the gardener who tended the lily pond.
So we're moving to France?
We're moving to France, big time, yes.
So we've gone.
I must say that there is one story that takes place in Holland because what is Belgium now? Because of Van Gogh, the painting called The Potato Eaters is the subject of one of those characters come to life and have a traumatic family event. And there's one that takes place in part in Italy and France. Modigliani's orphaned daughter, orphaned when she was 2 years old. Part of the story is when she's 12 and living in Genoa, and Livorno, excuse me, and then the story jumps to when she's 20 and is in Paris in 1939, tracing the events of her father's life to try to make some sense out of his young, premature death.
There was a statement that was made late in the book. I can't find it right off the top of my head, but it was something about great art sustaining us in life and also in death. Do you know what
I'm talking about? Oh, I think it goes something like, that's what great art is supposed to do, help us to live in the spirit and die at peace. Is that what you mean?
So, yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
I think it was a conversation between Artemisia and her father. Or some thoughts.
I think it may have been between Artemisia and Paola, sister.
Okay, right.
Paola, the other nun, who at the end of her life, at the end of the novel, is grieving.
Mm.
And Artemisia says this to comfort her.
This is a very emotional book. Was that something that you wanted?
Yes, and the reason has to do with Baroque art itself. Baroque art pictures human beings at moments of tension or drama or distress or passion. It uses, well, Caravaggio, in his chiaroscuro, uses areas of bright light against darkness. And it seemed to me that my story ought to have bright areas and dark areas and moments of high drama, like the art of the period.
Mm.
You know, and that's also why I brought in characters that were would seem inconsequential in terms of art history, or if I were writing a biography, which this is not. For example, the servant in Genoa, Renata,
mm-hmm.
or the cloth dyer. I wanted the reader to see that these were real people. Or the old woman, the laundress, that lives above Artemisia in Florence, this laundress who sings arias. Baroque art used real people. They weren't painting the ideal as they were in the Renaissance. Their humans were individuals with physical characteristics, a wart, bad teeth, dirt, humped back, hands stained by, stained and chapped by weather or by a person's trade. And this element of realism and individuality I wanted to infuse into the novel as well. You see, I can do that. I'm a novelist.
Isn't it wonderful?
Had I been a biographer, I couldn't do that. So, yes, that's why the novel seems to have so much passion in it and why I called it that.
It's really a fun read. And Galileo, come to think of it, he's kind of a good guy, too, in this,
right,
isn't he?
Right, he is. He's almost fatherly to her.
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be a, not a parallel, but a point of comparison between her father and Galileo. Both of them fine men. Well, maybe I should say both of them renowned men.
There you go. You also make allusions to the persecution that Galileo suffered at the hands of the Pope over his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
This is a backdrop to the whole period.
It was a rough period, not just for women.
Mm-hmm. Anyone that went against those good old traditional values.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. In that case, the church.
And the state, the Roman state, comes off pretty nastily in this one as well, with the trial of Artemisia being the key point of just horror. You start off the book with a bang, Susan.
With that description of the inquisitor's noose hanging above the papal court, stretching grotesquely down the wall, its shape, the outline of a tear.
And then we have that element of torture that sort of hangs like a pall over the whole book in the background, that torture that Artemisia had to endure. I had never heard of that particular kind of torture. Was that something that was common back then?
I don't know if it was common, but it was used in her case, I assume, because it would cripple her fingers, and therefore it would diminish her capacity to take painting commissions away from the male painters in Rome.
Mm. It reminded me a little bit of the old witchcraft things where they would put the woman who was accused of being a witch on a stool, and they would duck her under the water, and if she drowned, she was innocent? Something like that?
Yes, because... if she drowned, then she wasn't using the supernatural to save her life. So they would assume that then she was innocent and would go to heaven. If she didn't drown, then she was using the some connection with supernatural power, and therefore she must be a witch, and then she was burned. I used to teach... The Crucible and Scarlet Letter and all of those American classics that exposed that human beings can be mighty cruel to one another. That's, Huck Finn says that, but boy, it sure applies.
And the lives of women are better now than then. Obviously, there's still a lot that can be improved, but... The lives of women, as you portray it in this book, wow.
Oh, I know. But, you know, there's some issues that women are still dealing with and that Artemisia had to, and that is, does one choose one's beloved creative side, or does one be a good mother? Devoting all one's time to one's children. You know, Artemisia wasn't so great a mother.
Uh-huh.
She was, she constantly had to make decisions between motherhood and painting, between being a wife, between being a dutiful daughter and a daughter that demanded things of her father. Find me a husband outside of Rome. I've got to leave. Certainly that wasn't a common way for a Renaissance 18-year-old to speak to her father.
So these are still decisions that are being made all the time by women, just in different ways.
And with perhaps less less scandal attached to the decisions one makes, of course. Mm-hmm. Less judgment, I should say.
Well, Susan, thank you for another wonderful book.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a great experience for me to submerge myself in Italy.
I can imagine. The book is The Passion of Artemisia. Susan Vreeland wrote it. She's been our guest today on the Book Nook. Do you have any parting thoughts?
I do have one. If people would like to see her paintings as they read the book, they can go to my website, svreeland.com. All of the paintings are there. with correlative passages from the novel.
And it's fun. It's fun to go there. That's S. Vreeland, V-R-E-E-L-A-N-D.
Yes, my first initial and then Vreeland. Or they can do Susan Vreeland. Either one will work.
Okay. Could you stay on the line, Susan?
Yes.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to my 2002 interview with the late Susan Vreeland. She died last year, and we were talking about her novel, The Passion of Artemisia. That was her second appearance on the program out of three that she made. And I called her on the telephone at her home in San Diego, and I always loved talking to her. She was a favorite guest of mine. And we have a little bit of extra time on the program this morning, and we've been going back and digitizing some of the interviews I did many years ago on the show. And we found something that I originally wrote and aired back on the Excursions show that I hosted back in 2003. And it's just a little bonus, a little bit of autobiography. You could call it a poem. You could call it prose. Call it whatever you like. I call it Bicycle.
Our parents give us many gifts, the way we look, the things we believe in. My father gave me a gift. The date was September 7th, 1965, late afternoon. My dad presented me with a metallic green Schwinn 10-speed bicycle. I was the only kid in the fifth grade who could boast such a dazzling machine. Almost 38 years later, my father's gift exerts a profound influence on my life. That green machine is just a memory. It started me on the bicycle road. It has been the sweetest of journeys. I ride my bicycle every day, winter and summer, spring and fall. I ride it to work. It carries me to all the places that I wish to go. On mornings when the mist shrouds the fields, across landscapes surveyed by buzzards and soaring hawks, past freshly plowed lands. Deer vault across my path. The occasional automotive commuter hurtles by me, oblivious to the sounds of insect choirs, the scent of lilacs, the cries of crows. My father gave me a gift. As I pedal along life's course, I have time, precious moments of peace to ponder the problems. Dazzling vistas unfold. My heart swells with joy, and I ride. From village to solitary forest dwelling, through swarms of gnats, between shimmering trees, a heron stalks a minnow, a goose guards the nest. Startled mallards startle me. Life's a breeze on a bicycle. I've never had the license to drive because I much prefer being alive.
I call that piece Bicycle, and that was a little extra for you on the Best of the Book Nook today. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow for the Best of the Book Nook at 10:30. I'm going to bring you my 2003 interview with Christopher Hitchens. He died in 2011, and in 2003, on his only appearance on the program, Hitchens talked about the Iraq invasion. And if you're not familiar with him, he was a fascinating guy. This is from his Wikipedia page. Christopher Hitchens was the author, co-author, editor, or co-editor of over 30 books. He was a columnist, essayist, orator, religious and literary critic, social critic, and journalist. Having long described himself as a socialist Marxist and an anti-totalitarian, he broke from the political left after what he called the tepid reaction of the Western left to the Satanic Verses controversy, followed by the left's embrace of Bill Clinton and the anti-war movement's opposition to NATO intervention in Bosnia and Herzegovina in the 1990s. His support of the Iraq War separated him further. And at the time I recorded this interview that you'll hear tomorrow at 10:30, he was in that place in his life where He was being called a neoconservative, but he really wasn't. Tune in tomorrow for the Best of the Book Nook at 10:30 and Christopher Hitchens.